Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
I'd better stop it there, otherwise I'll be listening to music all morning. Good morning, New Zealand. Welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from the Wired It Up archive. Today we're doing one more chapter of Don Farmer's book. We're already halfway through it, so I'll have more stuff. It's all right, I'm frantically writing. So we'll have more things to read about once we finish this book. So we're up to chapter 5, Slimy Eyes and Hanging Pants. It was a totally unfair call, hardly true at all, but it was just the sort of typical remark an older brother would make when his little sister sidled up to him wanting a cuddle. In fact, the original slight laid out on toddler Elaine had even more bite to it. Get away from me, slimy eyes, sniffin' nose and hangin' pants. Back away she probably did. She had little choice, and from time to time the insult was used when siblings had a score to settle with Elaine, although the sniffin' nose portion of the moniker was dropped at the insistence of their mother. That was a step too far, she said, apart from the odd winter sniffle, totally untrue. Unintentional, though, it was an intended put-down, ended up being a blessing. It helped harden up the little girl's resolve, and within a few short years, slimy eyes and hanging pants was a force to be reckoned with. There wasn't much of her. She was verging on skinny, but was wiry and tough, a tomboy to the core. No, not one to worry in those formative years as to whether she should go barefoot or not, or in the part of her hair was straight. Elaine didn't back away from trouble. She didn't go out to cause it, but if it had come her way, then whoever was an opponent would have to suffer the consequences. It helped to have a father who quite enjoyed having a hard-cased daughter, who was only too willing to show her the basics of self-defence. He was a lifelong lover of boxing and used to regale his children, both boys and girls, with tales of the exploits of boxing legends like Joe Louis, Gene Tunney and Jack Johnson. As a young man he had taken his one and only sister Irene in hand and had taught her the skills to defend herself, including sessions with a punching bag. Irene developed a mean left hook followed by a straight hand, and girls who shared their primary school years with her soon learned to steer clear, giving her a hard time. Elaine was to the extent a carbon copy of her aunt. She even looked like her to some degree, a brunette, slender and about the same height. At Greytown School, young Elaine fitted in pretty darn well, with practically all her classmates. But it was a country school, full of high-spirited boys and girls who from time to time fell out of favour with each other. One day you could be a friend, the next day a declared enemy, and then within a few days would be arm in arm again. They were the days when a physical fight did erupt. It was one-on-one. Both boys and girls would gleefully form a ring around the combatants to cheer and encourage whomever they favoured, but there was never a thought given to joining in. It was up to those trading blows to sort things out, and when it was over, it was over. Teachers were obliged to break up fights, and they did, with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Some would step in, hollering and demanding an immediate end to hostilities. Others would saunter over and take their time before settling things down, aware that kids had to let off steam, and as long as they didn't cause serious injury to anything other than a child's ego. Elaine had the odd scuffle at school, nothing of note really, until one particular afternoon. A girl her own age got a bit pushy as the girls were queuing up to the assigned sports team during physical education. She sidled up to where Elaine was standing and pushed her sideways, attempting to take her place and jump the queue. Elaine bristled and pushed her way back in. But the girl was not giving in and made a second unsuccessful attempt. Elaine, aware that others were now watching to see if she would give ground, simply said, "I will settle with you after school." 3 o'clock came, and the old school bell housed in the apex of the primary school block rang. It was a primary and district high school, and Elaine made a beeline for her stroppy opponent, catching up with her outside the school's dental clinic, where there was a strip of lawn. The girl seemed far less inclined to mix it by now, but not wanting to be seen to be backing away, she flew at Elaine. But she made a very big mistake. She grabbed Elaine by the hair. In a flash, Elaine realized she had the advantage. The hair pull wasn't hurting, and her opponent was close up and her guard was down. She eyed her opponent, clenching her hands into fists and let fly. A left cross caught her rival flush on the cheek and a straight right followed, connecting with her top lip and nose. Down went the girl on her back to the grass. That was enough. Elaine's honour had been restored, and her beaten opponent, crying probably more through humiliation than actual pain, stumbled away. Young Don Farmer, watching proceedings from the sideline, nudged his copper, David White. "That's my sister," he said, pointing to the victor. "She won." The two siblings shared many experiences, not being too far distant age with Elaine, just being the right age to be a big sister, but still young enough to share and enjoy many things her younger brother enjoyed. One experience which was to end particularly badly for both of them started out innocently enough. Every so often, the Greytown School Committee and staff held a fundraising gala day. Half the town turned out to support the school by spending a few shillings at the stalls and selling homemade cakes, second-hand books and magazines, handcrafts and knick-knacks, to watch their children or grandchildren having fun and to catch up on whatever gossip was doing the rounds of town. Perk Hammond would invariably be on hand, running the big wheel. It seemed to be the job that Perk copped at every gala, church fair and picnic day. His voice had just the right pitch for him to be heard over the hubble and bubble, and he had a knack of being able to cajole hesitant fathers and mothers into buying a ticket with a promise of a prize or appeals for them to support this worthy cause. There would be tractor rides and pony rides for the kids, a lolly scramble, running races, and in the days before it was declared to be animal cruelty, a catch the greasy pig contest. This day Elaine and Don were in cahoots. Each had saved up as much money as they could manage to squander at the gala and were overjoyed to see the candy floss machine was in business on the paved outdoor basketball court. Candy floss was a favourite indulgence for both of them, and it didn't matter a jot to either of them that today's offering was green candy floss, a departure from the usual pink. They got to work hoeing into mouthfuls of the tasty sugary treat, precisely rolled onto a wooden stick. In between rides and trawling through books and offering at other stalls, the two returned again and again to the candy floss makers. Soon the money ran out, but there was a saviour. Elaine spied their uncle Laurie. He was an easy touch for a loan. Laurie liked to splash out the cash, or at least liked to be seen to splash out the cash if he was in the company of others. Anyway, dishing out cash for nieces and nephews was what uncles were for, wasn't it? Brazenly, Elaine hit Uncle Laurie up and soon returned to share the spoils with her younger brother. Wow, it was a generous contribution, almost reinstating what they'd started out with. Candy floss maker, here we come again. And again. And again. As the afternoon drew to a close, green was not only the colour of the candy floss, it was an apt description of the state of the health of Elaine and Don. Both were seriously overloaded with sugar, only just managing to make it home before illness hit. Regurgitation, plenty of it and regularly, was accompanied by a scolding from Mother. How could they be so stupid? But concern gave way to real worry as the two siblings, now bedridden with pans at the ready, showed signs of real alarm. There was only one thing for it. The doctor would need to be called. Dr. Doug Banks was a busy man at the best of times, but he did make home calls when pressed. He duly arrived to be faced with two children, still regurgitating the revolting green aftermath of extreme folly. Advice, medicine of some description and reassurance that the two would recover put Mother's mind at rest. Rest was what followed, with both children not being able to go to school for several days after, as they recovered their strength and appetite. A lesson had to be learned. Candy floss, no matter if it was pink or green, was never taken orally by either of them ever again. As Dr. Banks made ready to leave the property, he thought back to an earlier occasion at the farmer-owned home just around the corner in Horton Avenue that had involved overindulgence also caused by something green, but not candy floss. The previous summer, Ron, father of Elaine and Don, had grown a paddock of peas for the market. It was a good one. One could say almost a bumper crop. And then he knew he would need all hands on deck to pick them. The call went out to Auntie Annie Challis, who signed on and came down from her home in Carterton. Then Ron raked in his sister Irene, who lived in Hastwell Street and arrived at the plot with her son Rodney. Soon picking was in full swing and bag after bag of beautiful green peas bulging in their pods were being harvested. The temptation to try a few was hard to resist, and most pickers popped half a handful into their mouths. Annie Challis was a tough old cookie, but she had a few miles under her belt and knew the pitfalls relating to just about anything in life. Several times during the day she warned the children, helping with the picking, not to eat too many, as they could create gas, she said. The afternoon wore on, and by 4 p.m., Ron was satisfied that enough had been done for the day. There was a good stack of peas ready to be sending off to the markets in Wellington. The pickers dispersed, with Irene deciding to call in to her mother's home in Horton Avenue before venturing back to her own house. With Rodney in tow, she walked the short distance to Olive Farmer's wee cottage. As she, her mother, and Olive's companion help Anne Larson sat talking, Rodney went strangely quiet. Then he began to grimace. Soon he was in obvious agony with stomach pains. Irene, Anne, and especially Olive were easily panic-stricken at the best of times and now went into a complete spiral. They ushered Rodney into Olive's front room, laying him on the bed, and summoned Dr. Banks. The doctor was never over the moon with joy to be called out, especially if he was in his tennis whites doing battle on the courts at Soldiers Memorial Park. But he knew he had a duty of care and answered the call, arriving with his medical bag and a polite smile. In the front room, he quizzed Rodney, discovering he had been picking peas. He pressed and prodded Rodney's abdomen, then stepped back, remaining silent for just a moment, eagerly watched by the three worried women. "It's nothing too serious. He's eaten far too many peas. His stomach is as tight as a drum. He's got severe bout of wind or colic." The Banks questioned Olive's. Did she have baking soda in her kitchen cupboard? Yes, she did. "Then put a couple of teaspoons in a glass with quite warm, almost hot water and get him to drink it." With a wry smile, Dr. Banks explained, "It was like blowing up a balloon until it was fully stretched, then pinching the top with your fingers so no air escaped. The baking soda acts like the fingers at the top of a balloon, being slowly released, and the balloon, or in this case Rodney's stomach, will gradually deflate." Content, it really was just a case of hot air, then the woman relaxed and Rodney recovered. So, raw green peas, at least in quantity, and now green candy floss, had been struck off the wider farmer family menu. Right, we're quite a way through that one. We've got a little bit to go. Yeah. We'll take a break now. I'll play a piece of music. Because it is heading up into Christmas time, I'm going to play a Christmas song. This is one that came out a couple of years ago, but it's very good. This is Ed Sheeran and Elton John, and the song is called Merry Christmas.
Build a fire and gather round the tree. Fill a glass and maybe come and sing with me. Pour out the wine, let's toast and pray for December snow. I know
And that was Merry Christmas by Ed Sheeran and Elton John. As Elaine grew into her teens, she, like others, developed an interest in boys, one in particular. Trevenor Hemi was a good-looking, well-built lad who lived as part of a large family in a wooden villa along the Tauheranikau Straits. It was one of very few homes along the entire stretch and was almost exactly halfway between Featherston and Greytown. Elaine and Trevenor buddied up, seeing each other regularly and going to the pictures on a Friday night. Trevenor must have been keen, because getting to Greytown, usually by pushbike unless he could catch a lift, was no mean feat. Greytown was a small town, a place where everybody certainly did know everyone. Sometimes that could be a liability and sometimes a blessing. For Elaine, it proved to be a liability. It wasn't long before little tattlers relayed back to her friendship with Trevenor to Elaine's mum and dad, probably embellishing a little, the little that they knew anyway. Elaine was very young, at an age where all good parents kept an eye on what their children were up to, especially when they were entering their teens. It was likely everything would have been okay, but for one stumbling block, Trevenor was Māori. Elaine's parents decided the friendship would have to end, and the only way that could be attained was to forbid their daughter from having any social contact with Trevenor. The irony was that both Ron and Sheila Farmer had Māori friends. Ron kicked around with them during his high school years and played sport with many Māori mates. When he joined the New Zealand Railways, he not only worked alongside Māori, but also Pacific Islanders, Chinese, and from many other ethnic groups. He rubbed along well with them and spoke highly of many of them. In fact, outside the wider family, the only other person ever invited to Christmas dinner at the farmer residence was Chris Yee, a young Chinese man. Likewise, Sheila had no problem with anyone from a different ethnic background, having especially fond memories of Queenie Titou, another Māori that she had known as a young woman. But now it was apparently a different kettle of fish for their youngest daughter. Elaine's older sister, Pamela, had run into a similar situation when she befriended David Morris, a part Māori boy from Papawai. David, like Trevenor, was a popular, likeable young man who had a special knack with horses, often riding into town. Pamela's friendship with David was frowned upon by her mother and father, also because he was part Māori, but Pamela was a bit older than Elaine, and resistance was not quite as intense. Forbidding Elaine from seeing Trevenor didn't work. She dug her toes in, flouting the rules, and arranged to see him surreptitiously. Word came back to Elaine that Trevenor had been seen at the pictures together and her dad grounded her for 6 months. Her freedom of movement, other than going to the pictures, were not affected, apart from the blanket ban on seeing Trevenor. Each week, her dad would strike off dates on a calendar, and he never relented on the picture theatre ban until the 6 months were up. Elaine was made of stern stuff. She never grovelled or relented and devised ways of keeping in touch with Trevenor. One of her closest friends was Carol Flores, whose parents owned the Bluebird Dairy in the centre of town. Carol was always known as Flossie or Floss, and she and Elaine often visited each other's homes. One Saturday afternoon in mid-September, Elaine said she was going to town to meet up with Flossie. Her mother was suspicious. The two girls often met up, mucked around town or went swimming, but this time alarm bells rang. No sooner had Elaine walked out the door when Mother called Don aside. "Give Elaine a minute or two, then follow her, but don't be seen. Come back and tell me who she meets in town." That was just the sort of adventure Don enjoyed. And so too did younger brother Evan, who was only just old enough to go to school. As Don took up the challenge, Evan begged to come along too. "Well, okay. You stay just in front of me and do as I say, but don't be seen by Elaine." Out on the road, the two boys saw their sister up ahead, walking at a medium pace towards town. They stayed on the grass verge, far to the left side. Several large old chestnut trees growing outside the house of former Greytown school headmaster Daddy Nightingale had once lived offered the perfect cover. The two boys made a dash for the first tree and hid behind it, peeping around its big girth before bolting to the next tree further along the road. Elaine was approaching the intersection with East Street and turned left. Now she was out of view, and the two boys ran as fast as they could to reach the East Street corner. They peeped around to see Elaine up ahead and a boy holding a pushbike waiting for her. It was Trevenor. Picking up the pace, the boys arrived at the prearranged roadside rendezvous a few seconds after Elaine and Trevenor and greeted each other. "Hi, Elaine," Don said. Elaine swung around, the colour drained from her face. The last two people on earth she wanted to see at this moment were her two little brothers, both grinning broadly, "Gotcha," written all over their faces. As Trevenor looked up, somewhat stunned, Elaine seized her options. "Look, please don't tell Mum you saw us together. I will give you sixpence each if you promise not to." Normally that sort of offer would kickstart a bargaining session with the object of upping the ante, but on this occasion, with Trevenor being somewhat bigger and stronger than them, the boys decided to accept. With the bribe paid, and having given their word to Mum that they would not tell the boys that they'd left Elaine and Trevenor to it, the boys left Elaine and Trevenor to it and scuttled off to Garmon's Way's milk bar. Don bought an ice cream for sixpence, about the biggest you could buy in a cone, and even a bottle of Wacko pine nectar, which he promptly guzzled down just outside the door of the shop and returned the bottle. It now occurred to the boys the hardest part was still to come. Mum would want to know what Elaine got up to. They would have to synchronise their stories and remain true to their sister. Sure enough, back home, Mum bailed Don up. So, where did she go? Don looked straight into his mum's eyes, trying to look convincing. "She walked around the corner and met up with Flossie Floors," he said, hoping there were no telltale signs of ice cream around his mouth. Mum's searching look scanned his face. Then she changed tack, switching the direction to Evan. "Now, who did Elaine meet?" she asked. Evan didn't flinch. "Flossie Floors." That was the end of the matter, and in time the relationship between Elaine and Trevenor petered out, anyway as most adolescent boy-girl friendships do. Elaine's mum and dad never did meet Trevenor, so they never got to judge him for who he was, to ascertain he was a polite and fun-loving young man and not a threat to their young daughter in any way whatsoever. The way they looked at life when it came to race relations was not based on personal dislike of anyone, it was a hangover from colonial New Zealand. It wasn't all long before Don had a golden opportunity to smash the stumbling block Elaine had endured over her friendship with Trevenor. Russell Kennedy had arrived in Greytown School and soon made many friends. He and Don played schoolboy rugby together, and soon Chock, his lifelong nickname, had carved out a reputation as being not only handy on the rugby paddock, but very promising hockey player too. The two boys knocked around together, as did Chock, with a lot of other kids, and from time to time would go to Saturday matinees at the picture theatre. Chock would walk from the other side of town to the farmer house, usually meeting Don along the way, but occasionally greeting him to the property. Getting to the property. One day, after returning from the pictures, Don's mum posed a question. "Why do you go to pictures with that Māori boy?" she asked. To Don it was a no-brainer. "Because he's my friend." Nothing more was said, but a week later Chock called again. This time he was a bit earlier than usual. Don was not quite ready to leave the house and spied Chock coming up the driveway, the back door. He had a brainwave. Instead of scurrying to meet his friend, he deliberately delayed doing so. The back door was open. Don's mum was in the kitchen and his father at the kitchen table. Chock tapped on the door and Don, standing in the front passageway just out of sight, heard the conversation. Mum answered the door and saw Chock standing there. "Hello, Mrs. Farmer. Is Don home?" he asked, using the name they'd never used, always referring to his friend by his nickname, Buck. Mum answered yes, but he's still upstairs, and cooeyed out to her son. She had no option than to invite Chock to step inside, and he did so, stepping into the scullery and greeted Don's dad also. A little conversation followed before Don appeared, and the two left, heading for the picture theatre. Returning home, Don was stunned to be told by his mother, "That boy was so polite and nice. I don't mind you having friends like that." From that day forward, neither Don nor his younger brother Evan, who later teamed up with friends, including Māori friends, ever had cause for concern. A stumbling block imposed by colonials who believed lines had to be drawn in the sand, where there was no evidence whatsoever for the need of it, had been smashed to bits. That's the end of that chapter. So I will not be doing one next week. I don't think I'll be doing one the week after that. I come back, I think it's the 6th of January. If I get this right, that's a Monday. That's my first day back at work. So that'll be my first day back here as well. So we'll catch up with you. I think it's about 2 weeks. I'm sure it's 2 weeks. It has to be 2 weeks. So we'll catch up with you then. Have a brilliant couple of weeks off. Brilliant break if you get a break. Look after each other. Stay safe. If you're going outside, wear sunscreen. It's getting awfully warm out there. And we'll catch up with you in the new year. We've got a few things planned for the year. It's going to be interesting. Nowhere near as many books this time, but I've got other things planned. And I'm sure we'll share them along the way. So have a fantastic break. And we will see you next year. Take care of each other.